a path for the peace paradigm. King and Gandhi, many more, have discovered something core. Now we're building a path for the peace paradigm. Every challenge is another highway sign on the path of the peace paradigm. Ooh, 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 ooh.
Welcome, everybody, to Peace Paradigm Radio, a project of the Metis Center and KWMR Community Radio here in Point Reyes Station. It's our mother station. And our show is about the power of nonviolence, active nonviolence in practice. And today our show is going to be focusing on the yoga of nonviolence. So a lot of times you hear the word ahimsa, or you see, you know, Gandhi's Be the Change on yoga clothing, but what's the, you know, the deeper philosophy behind it? And we have in the studio with us our friend and who's a spiritual activist and an artist and a yoga instructor, Narayan St. Jude, to talk about this connection. And we also have special guest Russ Forbrock in the studio, who will be joining Michael Negler in his Nonviolence in the News section to talk a little bit about an organization, a project that has been mentioned on the show before called World Beyond War. So let's just go ahead and get started and turn to Michael Negler with his news.
Thank you, Stephanie. It's a real pleasure to be here with you, Russ, because you actually are our indirect connection with KWMR, so there's a bit of history there. This section, this edition of Nonviolence in the News will be quite amazing, not only because you're here, but because there has been a breakthrough in the technology of nonviolent resistance. And I'm going to save that item for last, because that's what really mischievous newscasters do. So there's an event coming up this month at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C., which has an interesting title, History, Rebellion, Reconciliation. So they will be looking into the history of popular movements in this country. That's April 25th at the Smithsonian. Later on in the summer, here's a couple of numbers for you to remember. On May 30th, on Pier 35, so that's the 30th on Pier 35 in San Francisco, there is an extravaganza called What's Possible, with all kinds of brilliant speakers, in which number we are including the presentation by the Metis Center that evening at 5 o'clock. Moving back east again, we are in day 29 of the divestment sit-in at Swarthmore College. Swarthmore is distinguished by two peace-related phenomena, institutions. They have the largest peace collection in the world in their library. I think it's the largest in the world, the Swarthmore College Peace Collection. And they're also home to the Global Nonviolent Action Database, which is being curated now by Lee Smithy. And he reports in an email to us that the Swarthmore Mountain Justice Organization students have demonstrated impressive staying power. I cite this because this is a move that's going on all over the country, that students are asking their universities to divest either from fossil fuels or from Israel occupation-related companies. And Stephanie, you wanted to add something.
I do, Michael, because in this relationship, my alma mater, little Mary Washington College, as I knew it in Virginia, Fredericksburg, Virginia, is also doing activism on campus in the administrative building to convince the administration to divest from fossil fuels. And what I noticed in a recent article put out by these students, so I'm saying that this is great work, don't get me wrong, but I just think it's very, very interesting when in reading their letter and realizing that there are some key pluses and minuses of the way they're going about the work that they're doing. So, for example, what I saw was an article written saying that, you know, they've been occupying the administrative building and that they've been asked to leave. They're not being listened to. They're being told that they're not being listened to. And that even though they're not being listened to and what they've been doing so far hasn't been working, they're going to keep doing the same thing. Right. So that's one thing that we could say. Well, if it's not working and they're not listening to you, then, you know, look at page 108 of Michael Nagler's Search for Nonviolent Future and understand that then you have to think about escalating or changing your tactics. Right. And then they also had a picture of the student group who were grouping together to do this, and they were all frowning. And they were looking angry. And it's like, I'm sure they're angry and that's fine. But I don't think it's not attracting participation to make themselves look like they're the angry people or they're not even attracting conversion with that kind of, a photograph where they have, you know, one administrator's name in particular. It looks a little bit threatening. And so I thought, you know, this work is about, you know, bringing people into it. And it's better to, you know, show that this is there's fun in what we're doing. And we're doing this because, as we've said, and we've seen others say in nonviolence, that we're on the side of life here. And so there's nothing to be frowning about at and threatening with our frowns directed at one person. Now, on the other hand, I see that they have a meeting coming up and they invited a lot of people via Facebook, a Facebook group. And one positive thing that they've done is that when you click that you will be joining this event, you're signing a nonviolence pledge at the same time, that you're not going to be engaging in property destruction, that you're not going to be, you know, disrespectful or engage in violence of any kind or bring weapons. So, you know, just some interesting ways that nonviolence education and studying materials such as those that are available at Meta Center could maybe help the divestment movement groups at the universities think differently about their tactics, because it seemed to me that this group in particular was taking a stereotype of what nonviolence is and then just enacting it instead of seeing that there's a real science behind it and they can change. So I was hoping to see something a little bit more sophisticated and found, you know, yes, some parts of it seem sophisticated, like when you click like, and yes, I'm joining a Facebook meeting. You know, that's a nonviolence pledge. But at the same time, the general strategy, it's not clear what it is. And it's not clear that everybody has a full sense of how they're going to escalate when that's needed. Michael.
Well, Stephanie, as an alumna, you certainly have the ability to weigh in and make your thoughts heard. And if they don't listen to you, you know what to do.
Thanks.
Actually, later on, I will be talking about demonstrations in Bilin in the West Bank. And we'll have the same comment to make there, that week after week, this is Friday, after all, if you're listening to us live here at KWMR. And every Friday, they're going out and protesting. And there even was a statement by one of the Israeli Defense Force soldiers who said, you can demonstrate as long as you want, demonstrate as much as you want, but don't use violence. Now, so if he says you can demonstrate as much as you want, what he's implicitly saying is we don't care. It's not getting anywhere. And that's where the creativity and page 108 of Search for Nonviolent Future does come in.
Well, sure. And yet in this group at Mary Washington, for example, recently was evicted. They were, you know, taken out. They had the police come in and arrest people. And you know, it's to me a question of, and their letter that they sent us that people didn't feel safe in the hallways, right? That it's causing a problem there. So these are bureaucrats. You know, these are not violent dictators. They have, never mind. Don't let me go there. I mean, just thinking of Hannah Arendt and what she has to say about bureaucrats and certain systems, that's one thing. But these are people whose hearts actually can be changed if you take the right approach. And so it just takes a little bit of creative thinking. And, you know, it's also very problematic because you have a group of people who are dependent on the university for their degrees, right? So they need to talk amongst themselves about what they're willing to risk for this. Are they willing to risk arrest? Okay. Are they willing to not take their exams? Are they willing to leave the university if this doesn't happen, right? So when you're dependent on the system too, you really have to work a lot, but more with them instead of, you know, opposing, putting yourself as in opposition to them. Yeah.
Yes, Stephanie, that's so right. It was reminding me of a conversation that I had with Daniel Ellsberg one time. He had all of this explosive information about the lying going on in the Vietnam War, and he was contemplating releasing it. And he couldn't bring himself to release it, no matter how much Pat Ellsberg was leaning on him to do it, because he said, what will they do to me if I release this? And then one day, for some unknown reason, the question inside his head changed. Instead of asking, oh my gosh, what will they do to me? He asked himself, if I were willing to go to jail, what could I do? And he realized, I am willing to go to jail. And by golly, I can release these papers. And the rest was history. So, you know, I'm going to play off what you just said and give us the bright side of demonstrators in America.
Okay, thanks. I just had to get that off my chest.
Well, we're happy to have been providing that service. We've got another group of 43 students, like the 43 in Mexico. But in this case, we have a brighter picture in a city that I know very well, being an upstate New Yorker, in Watkins Glen, New York. In three speedy hearings last week, a judge by the name of Raymond Berry granted a motion to dismiss all charges, quote, in the interests of justice, unquote, brought by 43 Seneca Lake protesters. They had been arrested as part of a sustained civil disobedience campaign at the gates of a corporation known Crestwood Midstream because of pollution practices in their town. And as if this were not positive enough, attorneys for the defendants announced that an agreement had been reached with the DA's office to accept identical dismissal motions from roughly 100 other civil disobedients who were charged with trespassing and disorderly conduct. Individually and in groups, the defendants who appeared before Judge Berry read a statement that said in part, quote, we only have this planet. We must safeguard it for those who follow. Would that it not be necessary, but sometimes citizens of good conscience must engage in nonviolent acts of civil disobedience to protect that sacred trust. And they said, we reserve the right to act as our conscience dictates in order to protect Seneca Lake, its citizens, and the surrounding environment. And the judge said to one group of these defendants, get this, he said, I am very proud of you. You had a cause and you fought for it to the best of your ability. Congratulations. And to another group, he said, I have grown to admire you people. Mm-hmm. Now, that is exactly what nonviolence is supposed to do. And their lawyers went on to say, we've seen a sea change in the way the court and the prosecutors have reacted to our cases. They started with maximum sentences and jail terms and so on, and they came to this dismissal, quote, in the interests of justice. He said their stories are deeply affecting. They are single mothers, winemakers, business owners, and teachers. I have watched the judge and the district attorney become very moved by the willingness of these human beings to make enormous sacrifices. And I myself have been deeply moved. Similarly, on last month, on March the 6th, we have talked earlier about the Creech Air Base, which is sending out drones over Iraq and Afghanistan. I wanted to report further that more than 100 people from 18 states converged on the base as part of a week called Shutdown Creech. And the anti-drone activists confront a challenging environment politically. Polls indicate solid support for the use of drones, though I hasten to add, this approval is declining. Support is clearly eroding, says one spokesperson, and our work, along with reports by academics, yay, spoken as a recovering academic. Along with reports by academics, legal experts and journalists, and people in the street in Pakistan, Yemen, and other places, all contribute to this change. Incidentally, since I mentioned Yemen, where you have read, I'm sure, about the enormity of the violence and the complexity of the conflict, might be good for you to know, and switching now to world events, that there has also been widespread, ongoing, nonviolent civil resistance employed by a number of different actors. In fact, the most significant setbacks to the Houthi militia in their march southward across the country have come not from the remnants of the terrified Yemeni army or from Saudi or American airstrikes, but from massive resistance by unarmed civilians, which has up to now prevented the capture of the country's third largest city, Taiz. There is an article online now by my colleague and friend Stephen Zunes and Noor Al-Haidari, which goes into great detail on this unknown, unreported, except for Peace Paradigm Radio, nonviolent resistance. Do note that this is only 4 years after popular resistance in that country overthrew President Saleh. In Palestine, we heard a talk recently by a friend, Iyad Bernat, whose brother made a film called Five Broken Cameras. And Iyad was able to share with us some of the statistics about the struggle in the village of Bil'in, a village of about 250 people. 450 people. 250 Israeli settlements have been built since the Oslo Accord of 1993, making those settlements illegal. In the year 2004 and 5, there were demonstrations every day. It then settled down to weekly, and I'm happy to report that Israeli activists have been joining every single week, as many as 3,000 people. Unfortunately, 40 demonstrators have been killed. I'm not sure you were aware of this. They've been killed by tear gas canisters. So the tear gas itself is not fatal, but in violation of international law, the canisters are fired directly at people, and it has led to deaths. But to end on a note of successes, their first success, they got the wall moved 500 meters and shut down 2,000 illegal apartments. Incidentally, the Green Line is 300 kilometers long, and the wall, the apartheid wall, is 700 kilometers long. So that shows you how much it snakes into Palestinian territory. And I'll close this part of our report with a statement by Iyad Bernat, because it touches on a controversial issue. The Shabab, the youth in these communities, very often throw objects, balloons filled with unpleasant things, and sometimes stones at the Israeli Defense Force. And the Palestinians widely regard that as a symbol of defiance, which is certainly allowable within nonviolent logic, and as a symbol of self-assertion and a signal that they are not stopping. But, of course, others regard this as a kind of violence because, in fact, one Palestinian soldier has been injured, seriously. So how you regard it is up to your worldview, I guess. And our friend Iyad said, the purpose of the stone is to get the angry out, to express your anger in that way. Well, faithful listeners, I have promised you that an astounding breakthrough has just happened in the world of nonviolent protest and its technology. It happened in Spain this past Sunday, April 12th, where protesters have formed a movement called Hologramas para la Libertad, which means holograms for liberty. Now, I'm such a fossil, I'm not entirely sure how a hologram works, but I did see on YouTube that in Madrid, 80 shadowy protesters marching back and forth in front of the parliament building. So you hear them, you see their signs, but of course you can't arrest them because they're only images. So, and this is from a country that emerged from dictatorship only in the 1970s. And, you know, we keep hearing that technology is going to change things, and I've been reluctant to believe that. But I don't know, maybe if you've got these shadowy protesters going around that you can't lay hands on them, so to speak. Anyway, it is an example of some of the creativity and the humor that has been applied, unlike what we saw in Mary Washington recently. So now it's my great pleasure to turn to you, Russ, and ask you, first of all, to say a word or two about yourself, and then, if you would, fill us in a little bit more on World Beyond War.
Thank you, Michael. I guess the main thing I can say about myself is that I used to be a defense engineer studying weapon systems. This was back in the 1960s, and the Vietnam War was going on at the time. I was marching on the weekends against the war and then studying war during the week at my job. And something had to give, and I finally concluded that war was crazy, not a necessary evil, and there was a nonviolent alternative to war, although I had a very poor understanding of what that meant. After 9/11, I revisited the issue and started studying what might be an alternative to war, and that resulted in a book I wrote a couple years ago called Transition to Peace, A Defense Engineer's Search for an Alternative to War. Then, last September, David Hartsoe, a longtime peace activist, wrote an open letter saying it's time to move beyond being against a particular war and start a movement to end all wars. A core group of peace activists assembled in January and started the World Beyond War movement. They immediately put up a website and had a peace pledge on it that says, "I commit to engage in and support nonviolent efforts to end all wars and preparation for war and to create a sustainable and justice and just peace." So far, over 12,000 people in 120 countries have signed the pledge. If you're interested in finding out more about World Beyond War and hopefully signing the pledge, go to www.worldbeyondwar.org. And I would mention that the group has produced its first product. It's a report called A Global Security System, An Alternative to War. It's an excellent document that brings a lot of different ideas together, and you can read it online or download it at the World Beyond War website.
Yeah, Russ, one thing that I like about that as well is that they've podcast each section of it, too, so you can go to the website and listen to it. Yeah. So is that – do you have anything else you'd like to add about World Beyond War, Russ?
Well, it's a fledgling organization. Mm-hmm. It's all run by volunteers. There is almost no financing for it. Mm-hmm. And the group is trying to figure out what their next step is organizationally. Mm-hmm. Are they going to become a nonprofit or whatever? And then they need to do fundraising. And then they need to have a public – awareness campaign developed, and so on. So this movement is just starting. The big question is whether it's going to be able to hang together and proceed.
Mm-hmm. Michael.
Yes, Russ, as you probably are aware, I've been suggesting to the group that it needs to lay out a strategy, or rather two strategies. There's an excellent collection in the document that you referred to of things that have to happen, which aren't just within the domain of militarism, but all the things that support militarism and its ideology. So suggestion one was to rationalize that list a little bit, give it a shape in terms of a trajectory. I was just reading this morning how, and I don't remember in what connection, it was Saul Alinsky who said, we have to start with doables, with winnables, and move on from there to things that do not yet seem possible, but will be after we've made these steps. So that would be my first suggestion. And then the other one was what World Beyond War will do to get people to bring these things about. And that would include probably phasing from constructive program to resistance, if necessary. So those have been my suggestions, and I'm happy to say that folks within World Beyond War are starting to take note and move, poke things on in that direction.
What's your feeling? They would be wise to listen to you.
Thank you, Russ.
Well, very good. Thank you so much, Russ, for joining us on Peace Paradigm Radio. I want to bring in our other guest who's in the studio with us as well, Narayan St. Jude, because turn back to some of the nonviolence in the news, particularly the holograms. And let's just debrief about that for a second. Do we feel like this is a good direction for nonviolence activism to take the human being out of it and replace the human being and the human responsibility and accountability with, you know, what is an empty image of a person, but not really a person? So I'd love to get your input, everybody, on this. And Narayan, I'd like you first to, I was thinking of you because we're going to be talking about yoga and nonviolence. And I thought, you know, in the deeper Vedantic philosophies, we're going to say that a human being is actually almost that stuff that holograms are made out of, right? We're not, so we're not there either, but you can't arrest a human, you can't really arrest a me, right?
Right,
but,
right.
So, say more.
Well, you know, I think that that particular action emerged because there's very strict gag laws that were put on the community. So, you know, they had reached an impasse where their creativity had to figure out a way to continue to express. Mm-hmm. You know, this is kind of off track a little bit, but in the news recently was this, I think, Florida postman who flew the helicopter onto the lawn of the White House. Mm-hmm. And he said that the reason he did that, he claimed, was to bring attention to campaign finance reform, mm-hmm. you know, and everyone thought, well, God, that's so silly. But of course, every major news channel talked about campaign finance reform. So he didn't have a sign, a hologram, or anything. He just landed a helicopter on a place that's highly secure. Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden this was, at least in terms of bringing attention to the issue, blew up and was very, very huge, you know. Mm-hmm. So in terms of the story, in which is one of the strategies we have to work on, you see that it was actually really, really effective, at least in getting the story into the mainstream and into a discussion. Mm-hmm. However, you know, depending on what stage we're at, if you start to pull, you know, human bodies out of it, if we just stay at home and project our activism, you know, onto the wall, I something I struggled with when I was earning my master's degree, a master's of fine art, where I was trying to find ways to find altruistic modes of expression. You know, there's a lot of protest art out there. Mm-hmm. But I found myself really frustrated, feeling I was getting stuck in a symbolic realm. Mm-hmm. Have you heard that frustration before, Michael? People feel like it's just all symbols, but there doesn't feel any teeth in it.
Narayan, everything I write, everything I say has a chapter, as you know, on the futility of that which is only symbolic, or sometimes we call it a sign mm-hmm. rather than a symbol.
Right.
Symbols are incredibly powerful when they arise naturally out of concretes. Mm-hmm. But they're very, very slender reeds to lean on if you don't have a concrete behind them.
Right. You know, so I often, you know, see a lot of those issues that way, you know, those expressions.
So for those of you who are just tuning in, you're listening to Peace Paradigm Radio, and I'm your host, Stephanie Van Hook, and I'm here in the studio with Russ Forbrock, my co-host, Michael Negler, and Narayan St. Jude. So we turn back to our discussion about the holograms, the effectiveness of nonviolence, the escalation of tactics and techniques, and also we were in the conversation about symbolism. And what I know, Narayan, you have a phrase, concrete.
Spiritual concrete.
The spiritual concrete. So tell us, what does that mean?
Well, this was just when I was working with this struggle where there's a lot of us talking about these issues back in grad school at John F. Kennedy University, a holistic campus, arts and consciousness program. I mean, we are way up in symbols and signs, all high on symbols and signs. You know, I would just find myself with that frustration of like, you know, we're painting lots of signs that are kind of pointing in the direction, but there's this big gap between actually it may be qualifying as, well, constructive program. Like, are we really making changes to the structure, or are we just sort of up on our soapbox and singing to the choir? And so that term was like, can I integrate? Can I somehow have a value-driven art practice that when I'm working with certain principles, that when I create an art or a social sculpture, I'm bringing in certain principles. And so then I started looking for certain maps that might help me create that set of principles. And then lo and behold, here was like the yamas and the niyamas, or, you know, the principles of nonviolence, permaculture. There's all these beautiful holistic maps that we could start to follow to actually create social sculpture and create art.
You know, what this has brought up for me, Narayan, is I think a question that could be very useful for the progressive movement. And that is, can we settle on a few criteria, a few guidelines that would enable us to discriminate between what we might call an empty symbol and an act that has a powerful symbolic resonance? Mm. I mean, an example of the former might be the way that we often get out on the street and we march from point A to point B, where neither of them has really anything to do with the issue. Mm-hmm. And an example of the latter would be, I mean, the classic example is that pinch of salt that Gandhi picked up on the sea at Dundan that brought down an empire. So I think it's a fascinating topic, and I'd invite our listeners to get a hold of us and see if you can extend the conversation we're having here.
So let me see. You know, what this makes me think of as well as I'm thinking of the symbolic and the concrete is the matter of consequence, right? Because as we've discussed before, when Mubarak Awad's in Palestine during one of the intifadas, was it the first or the second intifada, where they're waving a flag and they're putting flags on their balconies, and Michael said, well, you know, flags, that this is symbolic action, and Mubarak said to you, it would be symbolic action, but we're not allowed to wave our flags. And so all of a sudden the act becomes consequential, mm-hmm. that you're taking a risk for that act. And similarly, when you were a part of the free speech movement, Michael, in the 60s, it was a conversation not about free speech, but about consequential speech. Are you allowed to say not anything? Are you allowed to have speech that's politically consequential? And so, Narayan, can you talk a little bit about I'm wondering if there is a relationship in this kind of spiritual concrete and symbolic concrete about consequence. Mm-hmm. You know, what does this look like, you know, symbolism that has consequence, and how does that change things?
I think, you know, it's funny, when I drew out the map of the spiritual concrete, and it had all these different fields, you know, there was a field that, you know, it should be green, it should be ecological, it should be transparent, which means it should be honest, and so on and so forth. But then I realized I had to bring in two kind of personalized fields. You know, one was worldview, like, how are you looking at art? Where are you? What is your paradigm? But the second one nails what you're asking about. It was risk. I think that's part of, for something to elevate to the level of art or get beyond sign and symbol, I think you have to measure how much risk am I taking right now? You know, in opening your own heart, in challenging power, whether that's your own ego, you know, challenging that power that keeps you small, or if it's challenging exterior power, you know, which art. And so, and then it can qualify as something that is lifting consciousness, you know, your own or the community's.
You know, Narayan, that reminds me, there was a film series recently on the Civil War, and my son-in-law watched it, and he came away with a line from that film really resonating in his mind. And the line was, all you need for a war is a flag and a lie.
Right. So once you have that worldview, that the lie would be the worldview, you know, this compact, and then the flag would be the symbol, you know, and then once you can put those things together, and when we step back at that and we start to look at the drums of war that are being beaten, and we can strip it bare to those two things, the lie that we can't cooperate, that we can't somehow use peace modes to get beyond these conflicts, and then the symbols that are constantly reinforcing it. You know, I think that they would crumble pretty quickly with this type of conversation.
Yeah, I agree. I feel that symbols have been enormously destructive. Hmm. And in a way, maybe more bloodshed has happened over things that don't matter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the nonviolent people kind of gravitate toward the non-symbolic and the real, which, again, is not to say that there isn't an appropriate use of symbols once we get this all ironed out.
That reminds me actually of a joke that usually goes around on the 4th of July and other militaristic holidays of that we're recalling the American flag because it's caused so many deaths around the world that whenever it shows up, people die.
Mm-hmm.
It's a joke. It's kind of a downer. Sorry.
Well, you know, I'm a son of a veteran from the American Vietnam War, and I'm also a conscientious objector I applied for conscientious objector status during the Gulf War. I was an Army reservist. I actually joined the Army Reserve when I was 17 and went to basic training between my junior and senior year of high school. I hadn't even graduated from high school yet before I had thrown a hand grenade and stabbed human-shaped targets with a bayonet. So, the American flag is in the pledge and all of the things have been so heavy, you know, in my life. I have much love for it. Mm-hmm. But trying to kind of clean it, you know, and resurrect this something positive in the symbol is a big part of the mission.
Mm, wow. Definitely have an interesting perspective on that. Now, and I think that you are anticipating Gandhi and you're anticipating nonviolence in this as well, because Gandhi is clear and he helped recruitment for World War I.
Mm-hmm.
And he was adamant that in order to be nonviolent, you have to be capable of violence. And it was his vision that soldiers, you know, are the ideal material.
Oh, yeah.
For nonviolence, because when it's not nonviolence, Gandhi says, is if you're not capable of violence, you're only capable of passivity and doing nothing. Said that's closer to cowardice to him. You have to be brave. You have to be willing to you have to be willing to do harm in order to renounce it. Mm-hmm. You can't renounce harm without having the willingness, because it's not going to be as powerful. And so it's just interesting that now you are a spiritual activist and talking about ahimsa and practicing yoga, which he also felt that hatha yoga would be the ideal physical training for the Shanti Sainik, for the nonviolent soldier.
Mm-hmm. And I couldn't agree more.
So talk a little bit about that. What was this transition like for you? Where and how did it happen?
You know, Thich Nhat Hanh, who is coined the frame engaged Buddhism. He's a Vietnamese monk. I think many people are familiar with him, exiled from Vietnam, but very much he worked with many of the veterans. And so there's a lot of great reading about his ideas about soldiers healing. But one of the things that I read when I was quite young and going through that initial process, he said, you know, you don't want to heal soldiers after war, because if you do, they'll be the most powerful anti-war activists or peace activists out there. So, you know, you wouldn't want to think that our system is that cynical, that part of the reasons that we're not treating veterans when they come home, that we're not taking care of veterans and giving them proper care and treating PTSD, is that if you actually bring them back to wholeness, that they will begin to speak clearly about the horrors of war, about the manipulation. I mean, if you can imagine, you know, there was no meta center on campus when I was 17 to helping me to have a peace career, but there sure was a real hungry army recruiter who was ready to tell me everything I wanted to hear. You know, I was in leadership. I was, you know, my plan was politics to try to make a difference. You got to have a military career to get elected. You got to show your patriotism to get elected. You tell a 17-year-old idealistic young man or woman who is trying to move in that direction and there's no alternative for public service without, you know, or being some sort of peace soldier. You can only be a war soldier and just get plugged into this empire machine. You know, you see a lot of, I think, really good-hearted people who are ready to serve and serve selflessly with a lot of courage. And I worked with them in the Army. I mean, my unit helped get Humphrey the Whale out of the Delta. We helped clean up the Alaskan oil spill. I believe in boots on the ground. I believe in people getting their hands dirty, just not bloody. Mm. And we can do that together. There's a big difference.
You know, Narayan, back in the ancient Greek world, as I said, I'm a recovering academic. This is the academia that I'm recovering from. In Sparta, in the Peloponnese, there was a community that was kind of segregated and set aside to be victims. They're kind of like the Dalits of India. They were called the Helots. And this community was so disenfranchised that recruits into the military were allowed to raid them and kill them with impunity. In other words, they were just targets for these youth. And so they had to have a myth that explained why these people were so worthless. And the myth was that these are the sons of people who ran away in war. Mm-hmm. So if you couldn't stand there and face, and by the way, ancient war was pretty terrifying. You're not at the other end of a drone. Mm-hmm. You're facing people who are running at you with a big spear. and so if you lost your nerve and ran away, you devalued and dehumanized yourself by that act. Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is it has a long tradition behind it. Mm-hmm. Only with violent courage do you have access to courage, and that's why Gandhi was so keen on proving that the nonviolent people have more courage than the violent ones.
You know, it was really amazing, you know, as I reflect back to that, you know, when I was 19 or 20 and going through the process, I found that actually my company commander, many service people and veterans were actually more supportive and loving than the civilian community was. My teachers in high school, my debate coach, many others were so afraid of the system, of me making this sort of choice. And so when I went back for help, it was a time when, you know, there was yellow ribbons on every tree, speaking of symbols, and you just couldn't sort of get to a human place beyond, you know, if you're, what did Bush say back then? It was like, you know, you're either with us or you're against us. You know, you're with the enemy, you know, if you're making these other choices. And I felt that more from the community than I did from the people, the soldiers and my fellow soldiers and veterans who had actually taken on the duty and the responsibility. It's like they had more respect for it than the civilian did. And I only say that just because it's a curiosity. I mean, it kind of bridges on what you were saying. I mean, why is that? Why can't we get behind the resistors more? And this idea of sort of being a traitor or a coward is so rampant and among the civilian population.
We have to do it. And I think the only way to do it is to change the story, mm-hmm. as you say, change the paradigm. And the reason we have to do it is that the military has co-opted our values. People who have no other way of experiencing human friendship experience a bonding in the military, which is deeper than anything that they can experience in civilian life. Mm-hmm. And we absolutely have to provide that for them. It's no good telling them, you know, back away from that, give it up, don't do it. We have to provide a substitute. Mm. I know my friend Michael Lerner, who has yet to be on this program, has pointed out that when you want to join one of the, what should we call them, you know, the right-wing churches, they organize very effectively because they're very kind to you when you show up in their building. Someone comes and says, you know, you're welcome here and you're part of our community. And even these simple things that you were referencing earlier, Stephanie, the angry kind of fashion among activists is very off-putting. And without our being, I think we should systematically look at what the military does do for people and figure out a way to do it better.
Where I actually experienced some of the same level of kinship and camaraderie is actually when I came full around and I was volunteering and living with the Shivananda Yoga Vedanta Center, an international yoga organization who was founded by Swami Vishnu Devananda. He was a disciple of Swami Shivananda. And the mission really was to proliferate yoga and for the purposes of being a peace leader, not necessarily an exercise teacher. And so when we do our teacher training courses, it reminded me of basic training quite a bit. I mean, it's an immersion course. It's probably different than a lot of the studios because this is an organization that really rises from the comes from the roots of India. It believes in karma yoga, selfless service, living in community, simple living, high thinking, daily service, daily prayer, daily meditation, and a lot of teamwork. And so, but there was a period of we're going to tear down your ego and then rebuild you in the image of a yoga teacher, you know, whereas in basic trainings, we're going to tear down your I'm this or that from whatever city I showed up from here now in St. Leonard Wood, Missouri, Fort Lost in the Woods, Missouri, and now build you up into a soldier. It's just in the yoga process, we were actually liberating people to go and be an active force for peace. But those bonds were there. Those same bonds were there.
Now, I have a question about that yoga training, though, is where does nonviolence come into that? You know, we're going to build you up to be the image of a yoga teacher. Do the principles of nonviolence occur in that, and what are they?
You know, I think in these type of trainings and the way I was taught to teach yoga, and remember when we use the word yoga here, we're not just talking about postures and asana. We're really talking about a deeply psycho-spiritual process, a process of union. Yoga means union. Mm-hmm. But so hopefully we can create a space as a yoga teacher. You can create a space that is loving and safe where everyone has understands the agreements. And then in that space, we're able to introduce certain stressors to sort of show where one's blind spots might be, just where we might be holding on and being detached, just where we might be having our ego holding on and clinging. Sometimes, you know, it's not 100% effective. Sometimes we push too far. Sometimes we don't push enough. But the idea is that, you know, we proceed that way. Now, of course, ahimsa and nonviolence is the very first yama in the yamas and niyamas, which is the ethical foundation for what we know as Raja Yoga or even Hatha Yoga. So many of the seers and the rishis place tremendous importance on sort of like an entry gate into any yoga practice towards enlightenment or towards samadhi, self-realization, is the practice of nonviolence.
I'm sure you're aware, Narayan, that Book 3, Sutra 20 in the Yoga Sutras states that when nonviolence has been established in a person, in the presence of that person, hostility must subside.
Yes.
But I wanted to ask you, just as you were saying that, I had a flash that perhaps the process that you're describing in that training that you were going through and putting people through was the equivalent of a role play in nonviolence training, because that's what you do in a role play. Somebody pushes your buttons, and even though they're just acting, the button is real. Mm-hmm. And the emotion that wells up inside of you, the anger and the fear, is real, even though the threat is only symbolic, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so you have to deal with that, your anger and fear, the same way you would in a, quote, real, unquote, confrontation. Do you think there's something to that parallel?
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely. And yoga also is such a vast system. I mean, there is not just the postures and the breathing. Another, they say in many ways, the entry practice into on the path of self-realization is karma yoga or seva or selfless service. Because if there's no selflessness, there's no movement on the path, really. You know, how can we start to think about union if it's just me against the world? So, you know, you do set up situations depending on different individuals. They sort of enter at different levels depending on their particular personality. And then hopefully as a team of teachers and as a community, we can do just that, kind of create role plays and situations that will help them awaken.
I can imagine, at the very least, that we are, after all, in this samsara, this phenomenal world that we are caught in. We are so identified with our bodies that if we feel the strength and balance that we can establish in our bodies, it is translatable to strength and balance on the emotional plane. Mm-hmm. And I know I once attended a really eye-opening talk on Ayurveda, or India's natural healthcare system. It's called Ayurveda, literally means the science of life. Mm-hmm. And halfway through the talk, I realized, my gosh, I'm listening to a talk on nonviolence as it would be expressed in the world of healthcare. I mean, the way that you have respect for nature, that you're patient with your illnesses, that your assumption that nature has given us this bounty in a meaningful way. So I was wondering, as we were coming down here to the studio today, whether in yoga you see, as it were, the art of nonviolence applied to the realm of physical balance and so forth.
I hope so. Uh-huh. You know, I think what's happening is this tremendous excitement, and I think there's so many practitioners, and our system of the economics and the way that things are marketed, it's exploded. You know, who doesn't want to be healthier? Who doesn't want to be happier? But I think if you really begin to investigate and devote yourself to a yoga practice, if you're not sitting back into some of those concepts that rise out of Ayurveda, if you're not willing to investigate the yamas and the niyamas, kind of the do's and the not to do's of yoga practice, you're not actually going to reap the benefits as much. It's kind of like if you're going to go to war with your body all week, and then on the weekend go do a bunch of asanas to think that that's going to solve the problem, you haven't expanded. We haven't really touched into the real power of that holistic paradigm that mm-hmm. connects and understands. If I can be in line with my own nature and with the nature around me, health is naturally arises. There is no struggle. Or less struggle, anyway.
and I think that, you know, it also goes back to that conversation about some of the ways that the human experience has been co-opted by militarism, such as our friendships, but also, you know, bodily health. You know, if you're joining the military, you know you're going to be, you know, you're going to get some discipline, and you're going to have physical discipline as well in terms of how you treat your body. And so it's interesting that in nonviolence, too, and we can create an entire system. It's a place that Gandhi, again, he went there. He suggested, you know, this is, you know, think about what you're eating. Think about how you're moving your body. Think about, you know, also what you're putting into your mind.
If we're only preparing our body for battle or mm-hmm. competition, mm-hmm. you know, that's pretty limited. Mm-hmm. You know, what about for health mm-hmm. and livelihood and right. joy? It's a different motivation altogether.
So talk a little bit too about, you know, the spiritual concrete. Is that a part of yoga?
No, that was me okay. pre-yoga. And I kind of right. started realizing I'm reinventing the wheel here. Why don't I just, mm-hmm. I realized there was ancient teachings that were, and I had just an intuition that led me there. So that was pre, but I think there were some related concepts.
Yeah.
There.
Well, do you feel that, you know, bringing out the nonviolence in the yoga practitioner community is a part of that?
It's essential, and I think if we don't, we're missing a tremendous opportunity, which is why I kind of do the work that I do, and try to encourage us to sit back into some of these more holistic concepts and questions. I'm encouraging all studios and all practitioners to really reinvestigate and reinvest themselves, devote themselves to the motivations and the ethics of yoga.
Can you say just a little bit about what those are?
Well, nonviolence is the very first,
okay.
and truth speaking, being non-covetous, you know, just not being greedy. There's five yamas and five niyamas. I know Michael wants to get in here, but I would say go right now and Google yamas and niyamas and start there. And you could spend a month on each one and transform your life. It's a very important map.
Would you say at least a word or two, Narayan, about these workshops that you're slowly cooking up that would integrate nonviolence and meditation and yoga?
Yeah, so I think one of the things I started recognizing, you know, firstly in myself and then in others, is that many of us who are out there doing the work of trying to reintroduce the new story and live the new story, whether you're a care provider or a mother or a teacher, a lot of the most important members of our society who are doing a lot of the healing and trying to orient us towards peace, who are working very hard, are also some of the least supported. And so I think that one of the workshops I was calling ceasefire, you know, meaning let's learn how to, I think activists and all of us who are working in this way, if we need to take care of ourselves and get real. So just taking care of taking advantage of the healing benefits of yoga and meditation is sort of a first step.
I can sure see that. This is a very exciting program because I'm gradually getting converted to But I wanted to throw out another possibility here of a connection that I see, Narayan. That is that we know that people have mirror neurons mm-hmm. built into their central nervous system. So if I come to you uptight, literally, with my shoulders hunched up and trembling, I'm going to make you more uptight.
Yes.
And if I come to you centered and calm and relaxed.
In tree pose.
In tree pose, for example. Saying, go ahead, chop me down if you dare. That I will actually be producing that kind of reaction in your body, and that, of course, has a reaction further on into your mental state.
The rishis, the seers of yoga, they talk about these things in different places. They basically, I mean, Swami Shivananda, he talked about thought power, and he talked about how we are kind of like radio receivers. You know, we're constantly sending out energy and receiving energy. Now, pre being able to map this and see this at the level of the nervous system with our tremendous eyes of science now, there was already an intuition that this was true. You know, why do some people walk into the room and they seem to light up the entire room, and another may come into the room and none of us here and just suck all the light into them like an event horizon of a black hole? But if we're not, that the point, we're all capable. But are our institutions and is our knowledge system opening us to this potential? Yoga really offers many, many maps and many, many techniques to open the potential to rewire the neuroplasticity of the brain, to build new habits step by step.
Thank you so much, Narayan St. Jude, for joining us here on Peace Paradigm Radio.
Such a pleasure to be here. Thanks, everyone.
You know, and I want everybody out there to have a chance to think about taking in a deep breath after this program. We all deserve to check our posture, too. Is that not true? So until the next time, everyone, take care of one another, and we'll see you again on another Peace Paradigm Radio.